Welcome to Computing Lives, an author's podcast from the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. The Annals publishes stories of technological innovation, stories of commerce, stories of computing institutions, and stories of computing people. This podcast is a love story drawn from the January 2007 issue of the Annals. It tells how a group of students fell in love with computers and came to believe that this newfound love of technology might improve their very human social lives. The podcast is read by the author, Stu Gilmore, and is entitled Stanford, the IBM 650, and the First Trials of Computer Date Matching.
Stanford's computer activities took off in 1957 with the widespread use of Stanford's first large computer, the IBM 650, and with the arrival of computer scientist George Forsyth in 1958. Stanford began to build one of the country's truly outstanding programs and departments of computer science and engineering. One of the funniest, most intriguing, and creative undergraduate student computer projects was the so-called Happy Families Planning Service, the nation's first foray into computers in love. The project speaks also to the role of fun and playfulness in research and to the specific use of technology designed for multiple social goals. In 1952, Dean of Engineering Frederick E. Terman, Statistics Department Chairman Albert H. Bowker, mathematician John G. Jack Harriet, and electrical engineer Alan M. Peterson formally met to plan a computation center at Stanford University. My connection to these gentlemen was that Fred Terman was the first faculty member I met upon arriving at the Stanford campus as a freshman in the fall of 1956. Jack Harriet was my teacher in my first calculus course, and Alan M. Peterson was my first faculty advisor. The Stanford Computation Center began operation as a joint activity of the Electronics Research Laboratory and the Applied Mathematics and Statistics Laboratory in March 1953. Bowker had been director of the Applied Math and Stat Lab since its inception in 1950. The lab became not only a sort of holding company for government contracts, especially those with the Office of Naval Research, but it was also a campus center for the university's increasing use of electronic computational equipment. Harriet began the teaching of computer mathematics, numerical analysis, at Stanford, and Peterson began the first teaching of computer electronics, analog and digital electrical circuits. The university acquired an IBM 650 computer in January 1956, and the departments of industrial engineering, electrical engineering, statistics, and mathematics collaboratively developed a graduate program in data processing and scientific computations. A key accomplishment then, in 1956, was a position established for computer science in the math department. And the happy result was the capture of George E. Forsyth. Forsyth had been working at the Institute for Numerical Analysis at the University of California, Los Angeles, on a National Bureau of Standards and military contract. Political changes at the national level made things difficult for NBS, and by the mid-1950s, a number of good people had left the INA. In 1957, Terman and Bowker persuaded Forsyth to join Stanford and build up a computer science program. In 1961, Forsyth became professor of computer science and chairman of the computer science division within the math department. Early on, he added John McCarthy, Gene Golub, and Nicholas Wirth to the program. Forsyth succeeded to the directorship of the Stanford Computation Center. In 1965, the university established the Computer Science Department in its own right. Under Forsyth's leadership, his department became one of the most influential in the country, attracting almost as many National Science Foundation graduate fellows in those days as all other such departments combined. Some years later, the computer science department joined the School of Engineering. Stanford's largest computer during the 1959 undergraduate date-matching project described here was the IBM 650. In the mid-1960s, Terman had arranged to buy a much larger IBM 360-67 time-sharing computer, which reportedly prompted Forsyth to say, "Well, if we can't afford a large computer at Stanford, we might as well buy an even bigger one we can't afford." In a deal not so uncommon at the time, Terman managed to get the IBM 360-67 computer at no net charge. IBM sold the 360-67 to Stanford for one-third of retail cost, then leased the computer from Stanford for the period midnight to 8 a.m. each day and paid Stanford the remaining one-third. In a similar manner, the earlier 650 computer had been leased out for part of each day to Stanford Research Institute. The computer date-matching idea began at Stanford in the fall of 1959. Electrical engineering undergraduates Jim Harvey and Phil Feiler decided to take Harriet's computer course, Math 139, The Theory and Operation of Computing Machines, a course very popular with math and electrical engineering students. Math majors interested in numerical analysis were, of course, among students in the class. Electrical engineering majors taking Math 139 might also be taking the new engineering dean Joseph Pettit's Pulse and Timing Circuits class and Alan Peterson's classes in Digital and Analog Circuits. Numerous graduate students in various science and engineering programs enrolled to gain proficiency in large-scale data analysis techniques using machine language assembly coding or the relatively new IBM Fortran computer language, which became available in 1957. In the early days, computers were programmed using so-called machine or assembly languages. Machine languages consist entirely of numbers and are very difficult for humans to read and write. Assembly languages are similar in structure to machine languages, but names and words can be used instead of numbers in programming. Each type of computer processing unit, however, had its own specific machine and assembly language. In current usage, assembly programs might still be used if speed is essential, and they're taught in computer science classes today to show how a computer works at the machine level. For its 650 computer, IBM created a special assembly language called SOAP, or Symbolic Optimal Assembly Program. SOAP was succeeded by SOAP 2, and then in 1959 by Case of SOAP. The word optimal in the acronym SOAP refers to rearranging instructions on the slowly rotating aluminum drum memory in the IBM 650 computer. Computer software developers introduced high-level languages to computers with IBM's Fortran. Fortran was the first successful high-level language, followed by ALGOL and COBOL. ALGOL was used particularly by scientific workers. COBOL, emphasizing data motion and data presentation, became a prime language used in business. Many other high-level languages have been invented since. Unlike Fortran, written at IBM, ALGOL was produced in 1958 by an international committee. It was designed to be more beautiful and less machine-dependent than Fortran. Also about that time, the math department at Stanford announced to students that the Fortran language was going to be phased out and replaced with ALGOL. Few engineering or science departments paid much attention, and Fortran survived for decades in several variant dialects. Harriet's Math 139 class, including students Feiler and Harvey, would learn to use the IBM 650 computer's assembly language, SOAP. Jim Harvey and Phil Feiler wanted to learn programming, but also they were working an angle of sorts. The pair was among a number of stalwarts who Stanford student AM radio station, KZSU, had been thrown off the air in August 1958. The university clamped down on KZSU for causing illegal radio interference, operating with excessive transmitting power, and broadcasting less than tasteful radio programs, notably the steamy cliffhanger, The Stanford Sadie Show. The radio station had been authorized since 1947 only as a low-power AM broadcast band carrier current transmitter, with a studio signal fed to several dormitory booster transmitters over twisted pair balanced wire transmission lines to so-called improve signal reception in various areas of the campus. The students unbalanced the transmission lines, making radiating antennas several miles in length. This interfered with large commercial station KGO, some kilohertz higher in the AM band. Stanford Sadie was the on-air name of a throaty-voiced siren who tantalized male students on a weekly evening broadcast and who was frequently brought before the dean of students to account for the on-air conduct. Engineering students at the radio station treated it also as a center for experimentation with the telephone company's long-distance facilities. Harvey and Feiler already had career records of fooling around with scientific and technical hobbies. From junior high school through college, Harvey had enjoyed several encounters with the telephone company while inventing and utilizing his own toll-free telephone connection boxes and his automatic electronic dialing system. The other youthful adventurer, Feiler, had progressed from color photography development and primitive stereophonic music experiments. Within 1 week of settling into his freshman dormitory on the Stanford campus, Feiler and a pal, me, were summoned to the head dormitory mistress. We had installed a ham radio transmitting antenna in the attic eaves, and we succeeded in blotting out TV and radio reception for most of the dormitory residents. Subsequently, we also built a ham radio transmitter out of a table model AM radio and strung an invisible, ultra-thin magnet wire antenna from the dorm window to a tree. Older and wiser by 1959, Feiler and Harvey enrolled in Math 139 in the fall quarter to learn how to program computers, in particular the IBM 650. In the 1950s, the largest computers, built for research and government purposes, were unavailable to the public. Machines such as the Iliac at Illinois, Whirlwind at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the Naval Ordnance Research Calculator, NORC, built by IBM. Besides the IBM 650, other large computers available for public use in the period 1956 to 1959, although not part of the Math 139 curriculum, included the IBM 701, 702, and 704 series, and the UNIVAC 1 and 2. In 1953, IBM had announced the IBM 650 magnetic drum calculator to handle widely diversified accounting and scientific computations. It was widely used thereafter by universities and businesses. The first unit was delivered in December 1954 to the John Hancock Insurance Company in Boston. More than 150 units were sold by 1956, and nearly 2,000 were sold by 1962, making the 650 the most popular computer of the 1950s. Although not classified as a large computer, it certainly seemed large to us students in 1959. The IBM 650 was the biggest of the small computers, and its closest challenger was the Electrodata Corporation's Datatron. The IBM 650 required 16 kilowatts of power, and the Datatron 13 kilowatts. In those days, the IBM 650 rented for $3,750 a month. With its 2,000-word memory DROM and Type 655 power supply. It had an average access time of 2.4 milliseconds, using a decimal system with 10 digits per word. Its top speed was 22 to 33 operations per second. Its card reader could process 200 punched cards per minute, or 265 digits per second. Its Type 533 card punch and Type 407 output printer functioned at half that speed. The 650 was the only small computer to have double precision arithmetic capability, useful for statistical problems. IBM announced in 1956 that the 650 would have available as an option in the near future magnetic tape reading, alphanumeric data handling, floating-point arithmetic, and magnetic core storage. This was in addition to its then-available numerical data handling, magnetic drum storage, and fixed-point arithmetic abilities. The IBM 650 at Stanford was installed in January 1956 in the Hewlett-Packard Teaching Wing of the Electronics Research Laboratory, or ERL. The ERL was constructed by 1951 with half the costs paid by Fred Terman's former Stanford students, William Hewlett and David Packard, and also by Stanford alumnus and longtime Terman friend, Sennett W. Gilfillan. The ERL's Hewlett-Packard wing was the first large construction gift to Stanford from these two grateful electrical engineers. The 650 was about three times more powerful than the IBM card-programmed electronic calculator, which had been in use on the Stanford campus since 1953. To complete its reading, adding, subtracting, and printing instructions, the 650 used 2,200 vacuum tubes and 4,000 diodes. The ERL building was a low-cost, efficient structure with no frills. But the vacuum tubes in the 650 generated so much heat that the ERL's computer center was the first, and in 1959 the only, portion of the building to be air-conditioned. IBM instructions noted that the 650 did not need external cooling, but wisely recommended air conditioning. Data input to the 650 was largely via 80-column Hollerith cards. Data on each card were prepared using the typewriter key punch, which punched rectangular holes in the cards. Actually using the IBM 650 itself was a treat, save for the end of the Math 139 course, although the students were required to submit their punch cards to a computer operator who would run the programs. Weekly homework assignments kept the students, including Harvey and Filer, in line. Given the university's heavy daytime use of the computer, the large numbers of Math 139 students were allotted only 10 minutes each pair for computer runtime for their term projects. Sometime during the fall quarter, Harvey and Filer came up with the idea for a party. Now, Stanford University didn't have sufficient housing in those days to guarantee rooms on campus to male students after their freshman year, which forced male students to find rental housing, which they did quite often in the hills behind the university in Los Trancos Woods, an area of uninsulated getaway summer homes built for San Franciscans back in the 1920s. For some time, students had also hosted KZSU radio station parties and other parties at these rented homes. One favorite social activity involved parties with student nurses from a Veterans Administration psychiatric hospital in nearby Menlo Park. The student nurses rotated through every 4 months, so there were always fresh faces. Stanford's young men represented themselves to the nurses as officers of the Stanford Research Institute Junior Engineers Social Club. This designation was at least partially true, since one of the Los Trancos housemates, me, worked summers and part-time as a junior engineer in Professor Alan Peterson's radio research group at the Stanford Research Institute. Because KZSU student radio station parties were held nearby in the Los Trancos houses, the KZSU musical band frequently used the occasions and proximity to march, singing and playing at full volume around the Los Trancos Road circle loop at midnight. This crazy band actually had a number of interesting and talented characters over the years, including Bill Carroll, later a tuba player in the famous Turk Murphy's Jazz Band, and Michael Geeslin, later to be a noted biologist and writer. I myself played variously cornet, valve trombone, and piano in this group. The KZSU band formed the basis for the current Los Trancos Woods Community Marching Band, which was organized officially at a KZSU party on New Year's Eve in 1960. The band still exists today, performs regularly throughout Northern California, and has a large website. You can look up jimharvey.org/LTWCMB and find free downloadable music and many photos and other things. There aren't many 75-piece singing marching bands whose repertoire ranges from Wait Till the Sun Shines Nelly to Yes, We Have No Bananas. To get back to the date matching, as I've mentioned, the Math 139 course required a term project, and Filer and Harvey figured a KZSU Los Trancos Woods party could result as a positive byproduct. They decided that their term project would be to computer match a given number of items of one class to the same number of items of another class. The classes would be male and female subjects, and the population drawn upon would mostly be Stanford students with a few Los Trancos Woods residents thrown in for good measure. The project was called Happy Families Planning Service. This matching of 49 males and 49 females is the earliest known computer dating service. In late 1963, Time magazine reported on an Iowa State University operation, a date-matching dance using computers, as if it were the first such experiment, but this implication was quickly corrected in a letter to the editor. Filer and Harvey wrote a program to measure the differences in answers given by the respondents to a questionnaire. The original 1959 computer program, the flowcharts, data input questionnaires, and output results are today preserved in the collection of Jim Harvey. From the students' answers, a different score was computed for each possible male-female pair. The program compared one member of a class with all members of the other class and repeated this for all members of the first class. The couple, one member from each class, with the lowest different score was then selected and the process repeated for the remaining members of each class. Thus, the first couple selected was the best match. As fewer couples remained in the pool, the matched couples had larger and larger difference scores. Given the limitations of computer time available and the requirements of the course, Filer and Harvey didn't use a best fit algorithm, so the last remaining couples may indeed have been odd couples. For example, two of the non-Stanford women in the sample were single mothers with two or three children. One of these women, then 30 years old, was matched with a freshman male who played trumpet in the Stanford Marching Band. The social-psychological profile of the students prepared was, to put it mildly, not the most sophisticated of social science tools. As Filer recently recalled, well, Harvey had taken Psych 1. Citing no scientific literature, the two simply modeled the match pairs by similarity of answers. certainly not by the old adage of opposites attract. 30 questions ask for age, height, weight, religion, personality traits, hobbies, personal habits, and number of children wished for in a marriage. Some questions are graded across several levels, for example, from most introverted to most extroverted, passionate to frigid, aggressive to shy, lethargic to ambitious. Respondents were asked to indicate from a list their three most favorite and three most disliked hobbies or pastimes, and their political stance. Choices given them were communist, socialist, Democrat, New Deal Republican, Old Guard Republican, and fascist. Participants were asked to note their drinking and smoking habits and those habits in their preferred mate. The religion question was left open, yet the testers graded the responses into six rather unusual groupings. Mystery cults, Jews, Quakers and Mormons, Protestants and non-religious, Christians, etc., and Catholics. Most of the population sampled was between 18 and 22 years of age. Several graduate students and the few non-Stanford students were between 25 and 30 years of age. The experiment matched 50 couples, one of which was a dummy couple, for test-checking purposes. The sample was certainly not a random one, as it included many friends of Harvey and Filer. Other questionnaires were distributed in dormitories. As would be expected from the Stanford student body of 1959, the predominant religious preference was Christian, with 70 responses from the 98 sampled, and with Protestants in the large majority of those. Men were somewhat more likely than women to indicate religion as non-religious or agnostic. Republicans of one stripe or another outnumbered Democrats 68 to 24, with no one checking communist or fascist. As to smoking and drinking, both men and women wanted a mate whose habits were similar. Women were slightly more permissive as to desire or willingness for their future mate to smoke or drink. For example, a non-smoking woman might check that her preference was for a mate who smoked occasionally, or for a man who smoked a pipe. Most of those who smoked or drank alcohol did so moderately or occasionally, at least as reported. Women were slightly more likely than men to smoke and to drink alcohol. Of 49 males, 20 smoked, 42 drank, and 7 did neither. Of 49 females, 21 smoked, 46 drank, and 3 did neither. In all cases, if a respondent smoked, then that person drank alcohol at least occasionally. Women preferred larger families. The mean number of children desired in the marriage was 3.5 for women, 3.1 for men. Women outnumbered men 6-3 among those who wished for 5 or more children. The data have never been thoroughly analyzed, so it's difficult to determine whether the women had a significantly different profile than the men on self-perceived personality traits. For example, a number of Stanford women as well as men viewed themselves as very ambitious. It would be uncharitable to suggest that the number of men who checked very passionate as a self-attribute, or those few non-drinking men who checked heavy drinker as desirable in a female mate, were fantasizing about their chances for drawing a hot date. Although the class had learned the soap assembly program for the IBM 650, Harvey and Filer decided to use machine language instead of a four-transit interpreter, which used only 1,000 of the 2,000 available words on the memory drum. The IBM 650 employed a biquinary number system in which decimal digits were represented by a binary 0, 1 digit plus a quinary 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 digit in a 5-bit ring counter. Examining their machine code listings after these many years, Harvey recalled several of the machine code commands. For example, RAU for reset, add upper, referring to one of the two registers used for storing and adding numbers. The writing was tedious, but gave Harvey and Filer a high degree of control over the program. They submitted their punch cards to the operator, who ran all card sets for the class. Professor Harriet returned their cards with a grade, indicating their program had run but produced no result. That night, back at Los Trancos Woods, Harvey and Filer began calculating how long it would take to run the program for the total of 50 couples in their sample. They decided it would take 5 or 6 hours of runtime, whereas they'd been limited officially to 10 minutes. Undaunted, the duo entered the ERL computer rooms late at night and flipped on the circuit breakers to power the computer and air conditioning. They were aided in their entrance because several KZSU radio station student engineers conveniently carried lock-picking sets in case of emergency at the radio station. Because the IBM 650 was set up only for data entry via punch cards in 1959, their program started running and quickly stopped. After a few tries, Harvey and Filer discovered that the computer was interpreting no op, do nothing, instructions as halt or stop. They then changed the program so that no ops became jump nowhere instructions, and the program began to run. Another critical program modification made during that evening was to optimize the machine code by changing some of the address locations on the drum memory so that the drum didn't have to rotate very far to reach the next needed bit of data. While waiting for the first punch card to appear, hopefully telling them how many couples had been matched during the first run through the algorithm, the students went to the ERL lounge snack machines. And what might have seemed like a good omen, it turned out that the fudge bar machine that night dispensed bars for free, simply by pushing the choice button. Finally, after a few hours, the first punch card emerged, then subsequently results appeared more quickly. The whole process took nearly 9 hours. Harvey and Filer submitted a reduced run of 5 couples to Harriet for their final course grade, but left the complete run results outside his office, anonymously, or so they believed. Harvey and Filer received an A in the course. Examination of computer time logs for the IBM 650 for fall 1959 reveals that the total run time for the class of 150 students was a little more than 7 hours, or between 5 and 10 minutes per student team. Harvey and Filer, running outside of the official logged entries, used more IBM 650 time than did the entire rest of the class. At the end of the fall quarter, the date-matching party was planned for Harvey's residence in Los Trancos Woods. Because of his serious amateur interest in certain aspects of organic chemistry, Harvey had been practicing the art of malt brewing, and several cases of home brew rested in his dirt floor basement laboratory. For whatever reason, Harvey had used root beer malt instead of regular beer malt, and occasionally a bottle blew off its cap, shooting alcoholic root beer up to the basement ceiling, actually the floorboards of the house's main level. This gave the house an unusual smell of a mixture of Anchor Steam beer and A&W root beer. All 49 couples were invited to the party. Some couldn't make it. One young woman had become engaged during the trials. And a radio science graduate student cavalierly decided to go skiing instead. In addition to the homemade beer and other potables, the party afforded the revelers a chance to hear the KZSU musical regulars, typically consisting in those early days of piano, banjo, guitar, clarinets, cornet, trombone, and several kazoos. It was assumed that the closer the matching score of a given couple, the greater the chance for computer-aided romance. Harvey and Filer quietly slipped the news to male cronies, whose matching scores were low and who therefore were liable to be lucky in love. Scores range from under 100 for 2 lucky couples to just over 100 for several others. The worst mismatches produce scores over 600. As one of the test subjects, my score, as it happened, turned out to be fourth best of the 49 couples. The young lady paired with me, Miss McD, was an 18-year-old freshman possessing, like me, a Scots-Irish name. She was 5'7 and 130 pounds, had reddish hair and freckles. Though listing her religion as uncertain, in fact, she said her parents were Presbyterian. She indicated that she was neither passionate nor frigid and was of average attractiveness. She managed simultaneously to be somewhat aggressive, stubborn and irritable, yet slightly affectionate and understanding. As her lucky date, I was 21 years old, 5'10 and 160 pounds, and also had Presbyterian parents, as did a number of young men. I'd confidently listed myself as very passionate. Other than my dislike of dancing, Miss McD and I were fairly close in liking reading, camping, and concerts, and disliking dinner parties. On the big night, I picked up Miss McD early on a Saturday evening in my Austin Healey 106 sports car and headed toward Los Trancos Woods and the party. The date took an initial bump when Miss McD informed me I was driving at a somewhat too fast pace. Upon arrival at the party, the young lady candidly remarked that the house in the woods was odd, the KZSU band was too loud, the party guests rather strange, and the homemade alcoholic root beer not to her liking. By 10 p.m., the young lady informed me that she preferred to return to her dormitory. On the return, Miss McD constantly kept me fully aware of my weaknesses as an operator of a motor vehicle on California's public roads. Well, I didn't return to the Los Trancos party that evening, so I can't report on the overall success of the computer date-matching experiment. Among the 30 or so partygoers known to me personally, only one marriage apparently resulted. Having received an A from Harriet in the Math 139 course, Harvey was encouraged to soon enroll in an education school course titled Marriage and the Family. As his project in that course, Harvey proposed again to conduct a date-matching experiment with 50 couples. To use a cliché, the education school professor thought that Harvey's project was the greatest thing since sliced bread. The second time around, the party was once more held in Los Trancos Woods with the accompaniment of the KZSU musical band and the home brew. Several well-known campus beauties and yearbook queens were enrolled in the education school course, so once again, I willingly agreed to participate in the survey, in the interest of science, of course. Again, the overall best matching score was under 100, and the worst over 600. This time, I was matched in sixth place, only 2 points out of third place. And again, hopes were high for computer-driven romance. This time I was matched with a Miss W, a junior and officer in the Stanford Rifle and Pistol Club. Matching score notwithstanding, our dating history also ended abruptly after that one occasion. Following the computer date matching experiments, Jim Harvey and Phil Filer graduated with a BSEE from Stanford, Harvey in April and Filer in June 1960. Harvey then joined Lockheed Missiles and Space Corporation and also worked for Philco Corp., now L'Oreal Corp. Harvey retired as Aerospace Program Manager of L'Oreal in 2000. Phil Filer also joined Lockheed soon after graduation, then returned to Stanford to earn an MSEE and a PhD in Electrical Engineering. He subsequently worked for Stanford University and for what is now SRI International, leaving there to co-found Mirage Systems, where he has served as president and is currently chief technical officer. I believe this story illustrates the importance of student clubs and organizations, both as social and as intellectual resources. Stanford Provost and Dean of Engineering Fred Terman knew about this, and he made sure, for example, while overseeing the building of Stanford's first dormitory for graduate engineering students in the early 1950s, that the dorm included rooms for social clubs, workshops, and social gatherings.
You've just been listening to author Stuart Gilmore. Read his article, Stanford, the IBM 650, and the First Trials of Computer Matching, in an IEEE Annals author podcast. This article was drawn from the January 2007 issue of the Annals. For more information, you can find it online at www.computer.org. To find us, go first to the Publications button and then to the button for Technical Magazines. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Yes, we have to open it up today. Yes.